or passports. That the it has to be in.
It has to be the official Bureau of Statistics of the state. And
with an embossed seal.
Yes. I had a hospital birth certificate that wasn't good enough anymore.
Where were you born, by the way, just for interest?
I'm sorry?
Where were you born?
Cleveland, Ohio. Oh.
You have some more.
Thank you. But on the birth certificate, on the form that came from the state, where it says father's occupation, it says unemployed. And I was born in 1934. And my father hadn't, I found out later, hadn't worked for several years. And I know that they survived because he had an older brother who had a farm, and it was very, 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 very difficult. But growing up, I was never aware of that.
Well, this is why
everybody else was around me was virtually in the same position. And then when the war started, I was in second grade, and so we didn't rationing is rationing. We didn't think.
Well, this is really some of the questions you asked me. I think I really answered really to a certain extent in that vein. Mm-hmm. But and parents in general tend to protect the. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Children from this sort of thing. So when I say that they supported me, I mean, paid the tuition, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised that it might have been very difficult in ways that I did, you know, didn't know. I mean, you know, I assume so, because after all, everybody was affected very much by the Depression.
Yes, I'm certainly a.
But then there's another aspect, after all. It's true even nowadays, especially in the kinds of fields where you're in and I'm in, you do your job and you do it conscientiously, covered by it, and all these other things go on. You're moved by it, wish you could do something about it, but you just go ahead. I mean, you know, if someone asked you what were you doing the weekend that Clinton was in Vancouver, I mean, you know, how could you work while everything's going on in Bosnia? Or, I don't think that's really it. I mean, how could, talking about the period when I was or doing the obstetrics if you're in somebody's home delivering a baby and Germans might be invading Belgium, but you still go ahead and do what you want. Is it as worrisome as that is?
You know, there's some famous pictures, I think, of the in the London Blitz. It shows a milkman delivering milk bottles over the rubble.
That's right, that kind of thing, yeah. Well, one of the rationalizations I'll have for not being doing a better job for you is really to tell what motivates anybody. Say, after all, you spend a year three years in a psychoanalytical program, if you really want to know, and you still don't really know what motivates people. That's one of the more intriguing things about people is
I have noticed that in talking to a number of people that The question I asked you earlier about developing of the interest in science, it is in most cases not a light bulb going on and all of a sudden someone, like a revelation, you're, this is what you're going to do.
That's right, yeah. Well, also, I think one of the problems I think that you have, and is unavoidable, is that, I'm not doing very well on this, is people are very, I mean, you rationalize things, especially in a either in a situation like this kind of questioning or in general. I mean, what really, I think what really motivates one is so far law, you don't know what motivates one right now, let alone 50 years ago. And also you're colored, don't you think, well, not don't you think, it's obvious, by your environment. I think it's one of the problems you have now of, you wonder about, it's very important for the biochemical community. Is why is there are there less people going into science? Mm-hmm. Why are there many fewer MDs going in? The picture that I was portraying for myself and Arthur Kornberg and so forth was unique for the time, really. You wouldn't think it would be, but you don't have that now. Most of you, very few of the MDs are going into basic science. And that's a question that's really quite, quite critical, really.
There was a point when the combined MD-PhD program was...
That's still probably pretty good. But there again, I don't know. I'll have to ask one of my neighbors who's in charge of that. Program. What's happening now? I don't know where those people are going. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm sure they're staying in some sort of science, but how applied, I mean, how clinical and how not, I don't know. There's still, I'm sure, a very good program. But there are all kinds of accidental things, too, which I think are relevant. I think of the group here, and we'll go into it more later. I was probably more interested in not going into the practice of medicine than some of the other people who have done even much better than I have, much better than I have in science. But being here, almost by definition, makes a difference. I mean, for example, even despite the interest I've mentioned, if instead of getting assigned here, I got assigned to some clinical investigative laboratory, or you never know what might have happened. And
so your coming here was not really a choice? Although I guess we haven't,
no.
We haven't really gotten into that.
No, we'll get into that. But basically not. No. I mean, during the war you do a...
Right.
I mean, it was a choice that I applied to the Public Health Service.
Mm-hmm.
But first place applying somewhere was not a choice. I mean, obviously, right? In fact, this gets into a much more involved thing you want to go into more later. But it was even more true later for the Public Health Service. One of the very fortunate things for the NIH was that... see, do you have your cake?
Yes, okay. Yes.
Okay. Have you had enough? Or
oh, yes, I'm fine.
Some more tea? Or
no, I'm fine, more? Thank you.
You sure?
Yes, I'm a light eater.
So, well, we'll go into that in more detail, but just to mention, and that is that because of the fact that, in a sense, you had limited choices, they were able to attract people from the best schools, the best people, which they might not have otherwise. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those people, because of that, in reverse, went on. And Of course, you can argue perfectly well that if they were good people, let's say like Kornberg, they would have done well no matter what they went into. I can guarantee that, you see. But the fact remains that he got into science through the through this assignment, you see. So,
when you joined the Public Health Service, is there a commitment for a certain period of time?
Well, my hesitation is it's a difficult question, I'll tell you why. Well, number one, when I joined, it was a commissioned corps. And actually, I was in the corps until about 10 years ago. We'll look at that later. During the war, or during that, it was like any other part of the military.
Okay.
It was, you had no choice. I mean, period, you see. Now, over and above that, and this has no longer the case, it was a small corps, as I said, about 535 people. I'll give you an amusing background to why I know it was 535. Anyway, the list came out and I was the last one in this big book. But more interrupting since we're having lunch. And most of this we could take out of any record isn't really relevant. But when I was on the Coast Guard, it's rather amusing, where you sat at the mess table was dependent on your seniority. Well, since I came on January 1st and was on the cutter middle of February, I was the lowest person in the equivalent to one of the lieutenants. So I sat at the bottom. By the time I got to that table, most of the good stuff was gone. They passed it down. Well, then it turned out that while I was interning, I was in the reserve corps, so that to keep me committed, you see, technically, and that counts half times to a seniority in the naval parlance. Well, with that difference, I suddenly jumped to the middle of the mess table. But anyway, so I knew exactly where my rank was in the military. But as I say, this is not really relevant to anything. But the fact is, there was a small corps, and there probably weren't more than 10 or 20 commissioned officers at the NIH. And there was a sort of esprit de corps there. And I think there was a feeling on both sides that you were there for life. Mm. And if you did leave, there was a real feeling that you let people down. So that this is gone by the board completely. But that was at least the understanding. Yeah. And the NIH was an interesting place from that point of view. And that is that they took the approach, for the most part, that they didn't have big groups then, and you were pretty much put into something and almost by definition became an expert on it and developed it. So, for example, if they decided someone would be working in leprosy research or tuberculosis research, they automatically became an expert and were allowed to proceed even without further training. And Kornberg was quite unique and important in the regard that he spent several years, again, this is in this book, no reason why I should repeat it, but had did beautiful work in nutrition and decided that he wanted to learn some good biochemistry. And the viewpoint here was, well, you just go ahead and do it. But his viewpoint, which was of course correct, was that you go off and get training with somebody like Cho or Corey, and then come back. But he was about the first one who did that. Most of the other people here, including the big names, were self-trained. Well, I guess we ought to. When I bring this, do you want anything more? Do you wish you? Why don't I keep the fruit here in case you feel like having something later?
Otherwise, I'm fine.
I'll keep the fruit. And you don't want any more tea, you say?
Well, maybe one more cup of tea.
And then we can just keep that.
In terms of what we were saying, that this is part, that the NIH is a sort of unusual unusual operation, in mostly in a positive sense, but with certain technicalities and complications that we'll want to get into that much more later. But I'll leave that. I think what we're saying here is, the setup here is, and that's really more interesting than anything we've talked about, but also more complicated, is the NIH, because of its unique status, has many advantages and over the years, and many disadvantages compared to the universities. I think they're much closer now because the universities have developed complications of their own.
Well, yeah.
And it's remarkable how, and dramatic, how well the NIH has done and developed within the kind of restrictions of, like indicated by this case, by being a federal institution.
Thank you.
Put over there. That's fine. Or you want to sit over there?
No.
Did I was. Cake? I don't remember.
Yeah, we did, Sale. Mm-hmm. Maybe we'll keep that as how we keep the fruit.
And the cheese too, if you want.
Yeah, no, I thought I'd keep the plate. A saucer. Okay. I'll keep a saucer.
Keep what?
A saucer, yeah. Okay, yeah, thanks. Okay, thank you, Sal.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, this is really nice having the sun for a while. One thing I was thinking of, going back to the early days, I think one thing I'd like you to insert, a last discussion without going into any details, because I don't really know enough, but I think I don't want to underestimate what I was saying in terms of the record, really. The fact that, obviously,
without quite knowing how, one's very affected by the by your local environment, your local group, the prejudice of the period, the economics of the period. And I didn't allude to that much because you do as you do what you do, but it is obviously, as we were talking about over lunch, you do reflect what, without you even realizing it, what the community does, and what the community, you think you're independent, but coming back to the philosophy course, I remember Bishop Barclay about the illusion, or some of the others, not him, but you know, the whole question of how much free will you have and so forth. You think you do, but anyway, that's not in those terms, but I think I do want to mention that obviously I don't want to slight that aspect. But we like to believe we do things in a rational way, but we do reflect our society.
Was there, I don't know how to get at this, did you see any of that through the school, or was it outside of the schooling, the broader community?
Well, I'm talking about this now. I'm not saying at that time I was aware at all. I mean, this is just the way you thought you wanted to do things, but I'm saying, looking at it now, I don't think one, if you're asking me questions now and what motivates one to do something, I can't. In other words, I think there's no question that there were other influences that I wasn't aware of then, of the perhaps, or of the community. As I say, why don't more people go into science now? I mean, why doesn't it have the excitement now? I mean, why do people want to go into business now? Whereas, I think in my community, going into business would have been considered was something you wouldn't talk about openly.
It's what you did because you couldn't do anything else.
That sort of thing.
That's
exactly the point. I mean, sort of a little facetiously, I say now that you wouldn't be seen carrying the Wall Street Journal, I don't know how it is now at Harvard, but I certainly, it would have been unthinkable then. Well, anyway, whatever that means. Okay, well, now we can get to the NIH. It was a unique institution. It's remarkable, I think I have to say, and I've said this over and over again, I cannot understand why the people who ran it did so well. It was a small institution, long history. The Public Health Service was started in 1798, mainly to be the medical arm that would take care of the infant merchant marine. It was part, just like the Coast Guard, was for the same purpose. Marine hospitals were set up. Then the NIH started around 1880 in a small hygienic laboratory, a small room in Staten Island Marine Hospital. It was developed.
Was it called NIH?
No, it was called the Hygienic Laboratory.
Okay, that's right.
And I have it here. You may or may not be familiar with some of the book on it. I have it somewhere around. You may not, but
well, I can check that out.
Anyway, just in case you don't have it, there's a better one than this.
Yeah,
but just for your know-how, it's two books that you may or may not be familiar with.
just painted, and things are sort of still mixed up. Here, two books. Pride of the, pride, yes. Take my glasses off. A profile of the United States Public Health Service, 1798-1948, by Furman. And the other one is United States Public Health Service, 1798-1950, by Williams.
Yeah. Okay. I think that one's a little better, but
this one?
Yeah.
But anyway.
And by the way, I might say, in terms of the general history of science, as we'll go through, the NIH has been terribly important in the development, in the explosive development of biomedical science in this country and around the world, for that matter. I mean, of course, there are periods when it really supported after the war elsewhere. And very little has been written on the history. Interestingly, there's a little booklet that I don't think I have here that was privately published. I don't have it, by somebody who, class of 19, is now a lawyer in town, class of 1936 at Harvard, who, as part of his, for his college thesis, wrote a history of the hygienic laboratory, which was, he wrote it in probably the sociology of government department, because it was a rather unique operation for the government, having a government-sponsored laboratory doing basic research. Small, quiet, and it developed, and it was downtown near where the Kennedy Center is now, until about 1940. And along the way, the name changed somewhere around there. And it was run by a very fine group of people who were commissioned officers, mostly Southern trained, a number from the University of Virginia, people who represented I can't define it exactly, but a certain type of person, relatively more easygoing than the Harvard type of group, because they were people who had, many of whom had joined the Public Health Service during the prosperity days, when people didn't go into government service, and had stayed there during the Depression, when obviously it was a very good place to stay. But it was a stable group, but on the whole, I mean, they published very good work, but it was small and, on the whole, not associated much with universities, university people. Most university people didn't know of the hygienic laboratory. And yet, they set up this beautiful expansion and extramural program that was so important to American universities. Somehow they had the imagination to do that. Now, here's where Baird Hastings becomes relevant. But before that, I might mention another important factor here, and it lived up the hill right here, his widow did, but they were downtown, and the hygienic laboratory, and there was a group, there was a estate where we're located now, owned by the Wilsons, Luke Wilson and his wife, and he was Chicago businessman, I think it was BVD's Manufacturing, and she was one of the Woodward and Lothrop people, a local department store, but very wealthy. And there were two stories I've heard on why they gave the land to NIH. One was, which his son told me, and I think is probably correct, that he was interested in international affairs, the father, and international cooperation, and realized in the 30s that the only way you could get that was through science, so one of the best ways, and therefore wanted to leave the land